Ladies and gentlemen, you're extremely welcome here. I'm David Butler, and I'm the chairman of the Hansard Society. And the Hansard Society is very proud to be sponsoring this particular occasion when we're having a first government statement from the first e-envoy appointed by the government on e-democracy. The Hansard Society has a claim to do this because it has done a great deal of pioneering work on the links between the internet and parliamentary politics. And Stephen Coleman, who is our e-democracy specialist, will be coming up here after Alex Allen's speech to talk, to take the question period, which we'll then have. We have done some interesting work for Parliament in various ways. For parliamentary committees, there's been a particular website which has produced some very important and interesting evidence, secretly an interchange on domestic violence. Stephen has also constructed a virtual MP's office in terms of for the computer for MPs to learn from about how these things can be done. And some of this is dealt with in the Hansard Society brochure, which has been on your desks. Now, we want to thank certain people. We want to thank Rupert Penadray and the Stationery Office, who have sponsored this particular event. We also want to thank BT and the City of London, who provided the finance for our ongoing e-democracy program. And of course, we want to thank you as an audience, representing MPs and peers and academics and a few dot-com tycoons for coming here this evening. And above all, we want to thank Alex Allen. Alex Allen is a model civil servant. He won the confidence of John Major and then of Tony Blair as private secretary to the Prime Minister in 10 Downing Street. And when he left 10 Downing Street, he went off as a very real e-envoy to Australia as High Commissioner there. I saw him there with his laptop communicating with the Foreign Office and reading the English papers. And I think he was half concluding that ambassadors weren't really necessary because everything could be done by email. Anyway, we are extremely glad to have him here. He was called back from Australia to work in the Cabinet Office, the second permanent secretary there, to head the government's IT policy. Alex, will you please now tell us where e-democracy has got to and where it's going to go?
Well, thank you, David. It struck me when I was thinking about this evening that it may seem slightly unusual for a civil servant to be giving a lecture on e-democracy. But I have to say, David Butler didn't have to twist my arm too far before I agreed. I actually welcomed the chance to step back from some of the day-to-day preoccupations with e-commerce and to take a wider look at some of the issues raised by the internet for political systems, for participation in politics, and indeed for government itself. Even if I'm afraid I probably have more questions than answers, and indeed I'm entering into territory where I know that many of you have worked in this area for far longer than I have. I want to start, though, not by looking forward, but by looking back to some of the points about the way the internet and the World Wide Web have grown into what we see today. Because one of the key features, I think, is the way this growth has come from meeting needs and demands that were not foreseen when the first steps were being taken. And indeed, many of those involved in the development of key components didn't always approve of the way their child was growing up. I thought John Norton has provided an excellent summary in his book, A Brief History of the Future, and describes many of these episodes, how email was originally envisaged as a way of enabling researchers to exchange data, and the surprise and disquiet when people started using it to pass personal messages, and the way that newsgroups were similarly seen as a means of collaborating on research, and the horror that was expressed when suddenly they took a life of their own and out.sex and out.drugs was followed by out.rock and roll. And similarly, a little later on, the way that Tim Berners-Lee developed the World Wide Web as a means of accessing scientific information, and wasn't himself initially keen on enabling images to be included in web pages, fearing that would trivialize the medium and eat up the precious bandwidth. More recently, we've seen explosive consumer-driven developments in trading music files on the internet, predominantly using MP3 formats. And although developments like that were in some way foreseen in the longer term, the speed with which they took off caught the music industry by surprise. There was a very real consumer demand that the music industry had failed to foresee taking off that quickly. And as the internet has become more and more part of the mainstream, rather than just a tool for early adapters, so we're beginning to see a clash of cultures between those who want to preserve the freedom of access, the freedom of expression, and the creativity that's been so important in the development of the internet, and those who see a need for, or indeed sometimes a commercial argument, for introducing a greater structure and control in how people access the internet. And governments are inevitably getting sucked into this debate. As the internet and e-commerce have become more and more a part of everyday life, so issues like consumer protection, legal redress, tax, broadcast licensing, and so on, all have to be addressed. But I think what we mustn't overlook is that one of the key influences of governments so far has been the way they have largely held back from the internet, and their role has primarily been exercised through the work they've done in liberalizing telecommunications and promoting competition. And I was struck by the story that Lawrence Lessig, the Berkman Professor of Law at Harvard, tells about the way he was recently arguing with young congressional staffers about the need to ensure open access to broadband cable systems. And he was met with hostility and by the response that what he was doing was calling for regulation of the internet. And where would that end? And he had to go back and explain that it has been open access to telephone systems, in many cases against the wishes of incumbent telecoms operators, that has enabled the internet to take off in the way it has. So I think it is this free market culture of the internet that's in so marked contrast to Orwell's vision of a world in 1984 where dictatorship was sustained by complete government control over the means of information and communication. And what Orwell underestimated was the power of market-driven IT, perhaps not surprisingly, given that he was writing at a time when communication systems were so heavily regulated, and in many countries, indeed, were under government ownership. Governments have, of course, tried in some countries to take control of communication systems so as to hobble political opposition, and I remember how effective it was when the military leadership in Poland cut off all telephone access to prevent either internal or external opposition knowing what was going on. And it's interesting, that's become very much harder now, thanks to advances in technology. We now have a position where a journalist can file stories using a solar-powered personal computer and a satellite phone quite independently of domestic telephone systems. And the internet has equally enabled many people around the world to access information that their governments would wish to suppress, though we are, of course, seeing attempts in some countries like China to impose controls on access. But I want to focus tonight more on the implications of the internet for the industrialized countries. And it's in the US that we've already seen the internet play a significant role in political campaigns. In Minnesota, when Jesse Ventura, the former professional wrestler, was standing for governor in 1998, and he caught the imagination of many young people, many of whom wouldn't normally have voted at all. They became enthusiastic supporters, discussing and campaigning for him over the internet. And Ventura won despite a hostile conventional media who often sought to portray him as a buffoon. And in the recent Republican presidential primary, the internet helped to generate momentum for John McCain's campaign, even though it was ultimately unsuccessful. McCain started off with relatively little funding, but attracted large amounts of small donations over the internet. Politicians in the UK have been rather slower to adopt the internet. The majority of MPs in the UK do not use email to communicate with their constituents. In part, I think this is because internet penetration in the UK has lagged that of the US, although take-up is now growing very fast. And in part, it seems to be because of a concern about how to cope with a medium that can generate such huge traffic. And it's not just MPs who get concerned about that. It's equally government departments who've been reluctant to publish email addresses and to undertake to deal with the public by email. So I very much welcome the work the Hansard Society is doing to help MPs deal with emails through the project that David mentioned, and, for example, by setting up standardised filtering systems so that MPs can separate out and give priority to dealing with their own constituents. And we're beginning to see government departments making greater use. You can now email the Home Office about a passport query if your passport's got delayed, and they undertake to give you a reply quickly. I also welcome the work the Hansard Society is doing in other areas, as David mentioned, such as the promotion of online consultations and forums. And that's where I think the internet offers truly novel means of communications. It's a means of communications where messages and themes can emerge in ways that may not be expected as the participants bounce ideas off each other. One example from when I was in Australia in my previous job, I visited Adelaide and met Michael Armitage, the Minister for Information Economy in the South Australian government, who's a great enthusiast for online consultations. And he told me he'd posed a question in one of his online forums asking for views on a proposal to privatise the ports in South Australia. And what had surprised him was that the biggest single issue that emerged was the concern from very many people about whether, if the ports were privatised, they would still be able to fish off the end of the jetties. And so Michael Armitage took note of that, and that reassurance was built into the communication strategy. And it's the sort of issue that's very easy to overlook when a new policy is being planned. I mean, no doubt extensive public opinion research could have revealed it, but an online forum produced the answer much more cheaply and much more immediately. And in the UK, the Hansard Society's online consultation on domestic violence, set up in conjunction with the all-party parliamentary group chaired by Margaret Moran, is another good example of innovative use of this new medium. Some 200 women participated in the consultation, many very actively. And the great majority had never taken part in an internet consultation before. And while just over half had internet access at home or at their refuge, the rest had not previously had online access, and many used public access points. The Hansard Society is now preparing evidence for the committee based on that consultation. But what I found encouraging is that, even apart from the evidence gathered, some of the women who participated found the experience so valuable that they decided to set up their own continuing online group so that they could still share experiences. There are many other examples of online consultations taking place right across the UK. The International Teledemocracy Centre at Napier University, for example, has set up an online consultation for young people in Scotland that will feed into the Youth Summit in June, which ministers from the Scottish Executive are attending. The internet provides a means also by which information can be made far more readily accessible than was ever possible before. Almost all government departments and agencies now have websites that provide a wide range of information, and most local authorities too make extensive use of websites, as indeed do the political parties. And much of this information simply wasn't available to the public until very recently. And I believe these channels will form an increasingly important means of communication directly with citizens and with voters. It means, for example, that people won't have to rely just on press reports of a new policy or a new speech. If they're interested, they can go in and read the source material directly. And the US evidence suggests that internet users are a very demanding community. They don't just want canned messages. They want to be able to explore issues in depth and compare different candidates' positions. But it would be very wrong to focus too much on the role of official sites and official information, whether from governments or from political campaigns. One of the features, one of the great strengths of the internet, is the way it can create virtual communities who share a common interest without regard to their physical location. Certainly the community that attracted me onto the internet in the first place was the Grateful Dead, an American band where I was able to find information immediately rather relying on books that appeared later on. And when people have set up virtual communities with a common interest, they can readily develop into pressure groups, into consumer groups, political activists, or self-help alliances. And that means that organizations, whether in the public or the private sector, have rather less control over information. There are endless opportunities for debate and lobbying, during which messages can be transformed in a way the originators may not have expected at all. It requires a different approach to communication, and one that is only now being developed. I'm not yet convinced, though, as a recent IPR report put it, that it yet means the death of spin. The internet also, crucially, enables small organizations and interest groups to band together much more easily and to mobilize public opinion. And that was what we saw, for example, in Seattle, where governments and policymakers were taken by surprise by the opposition to the WTO, orchestrated largely by campaigns using the internet. And that's one of the many areas where the internet is providing new challenges for public policy. Take health, for example. The internet now provides a way in which individuals with particular diseases or illnesses can get together online and can share experiences and draw strength from each other. Of course, we saw this before the internet with support groups using other means to communicate. But the internet makes it much easier for people who may live great distances apart to learn from the experience of others. And of course, this creates dilemmas for public policy. How can people know that the information they are getting is reliable? One way is to use respected brands, such as the NHS, to provide information that people will trust, and that's what the government is doing through NHS Direct Online. But we may also, I believe, underestimate the ability of people to assimilate information from a variety of sources and make judgments on what is relevant to them. Indeed, I think there's a positive aspect from patients being better informed and willing to probe the medical profession on the impact and implications of different forms of treatment. The internet provides a means whereby information, whether true or false, can spread incredibly quickly. That can be positive, for example, where information about natural disasters can be relayed rapidly and where self-help groups can be set up straight away. It can be negative, as with scams aimed at ramping up share prices. And it can be difficult for governments to know how to cope when opinions can get polarized so rapidly by this sort of spread of information. And I believe a part of the answer is to use the internet to provide more information so that people can read or see the evidence for themselves. Greater openness can help to disarm suspicions. And I believe that the willingness to make information available can itself help to make government statements more credible. But there is a much wider problem of the suspicion we see in many countries about the motives of governments and the lack of trust of the political process. It's a suspicion often coupled with distrust in the information from traditional channels such as newspapers and television. And it can be manifest in low turnouts, in complaints about the system, and in a willingness to support candidates from outside the political mainstream, something that we've seen examples of in many countries. It's a real challenge to governments and political parties right around the world. And I wouldn't claim that the internet is a magic solution, but I do believe it can play a role in building up confidence in the political process and in increasing participation. Part of this will come through the sorts of measures I talked about earlier, such as using the opportunities provided by the internet to develop a genuine two-way dialogue. And part may come through using these technologies directly so as to help increase turnout in elections. The UK government has already taken an important step through the Representation of the People Act passed earlier this year, and that provides for a rolling electoral register and enables local authorities to conduct experiments on how and when and where people can vote. And this power was used by some of the authorities in the elections on the 4th of May. And those authorities are now preparing their evaluations, but it does seem as if there were significant increases in turnout where authorities tried all postal ballots. And all postal ballots does, of course, raise the issue whether we might, in time, go further and enable people to vote from home via the internet. I was struck by two recent surveys, one in the US and one in the UK. In the US, almost a third of households said that at least one of their members would be much more likely to vote in a state or federal election if it could be done over the internet. And in the UK, a recent KPMG survey asked people which public services they would like to be able to carry out electronically. The two most popular options were looking up school information with 15% of the respondents, closely followed by voting online with 14%. There are, of course, some key technical issues before that could be contemplated. There are justifiable concerns about security and authentication that we'd need to overcome before voting over the internet could command widespread confidence. People need to be satisfied that there are cast-iron ways of identifying people and of determining their eligibility to vote, as well as providing an audit trail so that any disputes can be resolved. Online voting might, I believe, increase participation, but it would also raise many more fundamental issues. Some people I know are worried about the risk of trivialising what is a key element in our system of democracy. As it was put to me, would it really help to make people respect and value our political systems if voting was simply a matter of pressing buttons on a TV remote control during a break in EastEnders? I suspect attitudes in society will change, and all this may seem much more natural in a few years' time. And it may be that early experiments will be more informal, seeking to determine views on local issues, perhaps as a development of online consultations. But going further and taking decisions in this way does raise implications for representative democracy itself. If local issues could be decided by online voting, and if people could vote online in general elections, is there a logical stopping point from all sorts of national issues being decided by online referendums? I think we need to think very hard before we let that genie out of the bottle. I want to go on to the direct impact of the internet on government itself. I don't want this evening to go into details about our plans for e-government. Much of that information is available elsewhere, for example, in the e-government strategy that we published last month. But instead, I want to bring out one or two of the wider issues that emerge from the work on that area. We're determined to provide access to all government services online by 2005. But the implications go beyond simply providing individual departmental services online, important though that is. There is a real opportunity here to enable citizens to deal with government in a way that suits them, rather than in a way that is determined by administrative structures and administrative conveniences. And many of the reasons that drive people to approach the government, losing a job, having a baby, whatever, mean that they need to access a bundle of services from different government departments. And what we want to do is to provide structures that enable people to do that by a single entry point. And there's no reason, when you get drawn down that route, why it is just the government who can identify the bundles of services that people want. In many cases, what people may want is a mixture of public and private services together. And that's what we're planning to do through a common gateway that will enable private sector providers to access government information and government services in a way that will be transparent. In enabling people to join up services in this way, we do begin to raise questions, though, about the role of departments and about ministerial accountability. We've got used to departments dealing with their own clients directly and feeling a special relationship with their particular customers. But what if the role of departments is to provide information and services which are then bundled together by others? This may well require new systems of parliamentary scrutiny, and that's an area we're going to have to look at over the next few years. Another key set of issues we will face are the related ones of security, privacy, and authentication that I already mentioned in the context of voting. As the internet becomes more and more important as a means of doing business, so we will need to have robust systems by which people can identify themselves online and can be confident that their transactions are secure and their privacy protected. And that will be true both for the private and for the public sector. There are a number of government services where authentication of identity is a key element, issuing passports, driving license, for example, as well as ensuring entitlement to benefits. And how will we get an acceptable system of determining identity without falling foul of the concerns over identity cards? That, again, is another of the issues we're going to have to tease out as we move to getting all government services online. As I mentioned, issues of privacy are becoming increasingly important. Individual departments hold extensive information about many people, and there are a series of statutory restrictions on sharing data or passing it on to others. We need to make sure that people have confidence that their personal data will not be misused, while at the same time enabling government to take advantage of the opportunities that the internet will bring for joined-up government. Different people have different attitudes here. If you take the issue of personalization of a government portal, for example, something we are working on at the moment, put in the abstract, it sounds a very good idea. If you log on, it can provide information about local medical facilities near you, local schools, libraries, whatever you want. But when you go on and you say, yes, and of course it could be that when you log on, your computer will, the government site will say, yes, and don't forget, Alex, you haven't filled in your tax return yet, or it's time to make an appointment for a checkup with your dentist. Then people begin to pause, and the image of Big Brother starts to loom larger. One of the interesting connections I've made through both my interest in the Grateful Dead and my present job is getting together with a man called John Perry Barlow, who used to write lyrics for the Grateful Dead and now does quite a lot with the Electronic Frontiers Foundation in the United States. And when I was putting some of these points to him, he came up with a very different point of view. And in his view, efficient government was dangerous government. So I think there's some convincing to do there. I believe part of the solution is to be much more open about the way government will and will not use the information it holds. And part of the solution on personalization may be to make it a service which people can adopt as they become more familiar with the benefits it brings. To some extent, I think this takes us also to the lack of trust in government that I mentioned earlier. It is a paradox that people are ready to trust private sector firms with extensive personal details about their purchasing habit, but are much more suspicious about the government holding information about them. I've so far discussed the implications for the government in domestic terms only, but of course, just as the internet transcends national boundaries in bringing individuals together, so it automatically brings with it issues that cannot be dealt with by individual governments on their own. There are a range of issues where governments are already finding they have to work more and more closely together across national boundaries, ranging from tax to combating child pornography, from security on the internet to consumer protection. And it's another aspect of globalization that I'm sure we will see more and more of in the future. I'm conscious when I set out the program like that it all sounds very orderly, as if the future were well mapped out and our task ahead is simply to fill in some of the gaps and to persuade some people of the need to change particular aspects. Well, I don't believe it will be like that, and I want to return to where I began with the lessons from the way the internet developed in ways that surprised and in some cases alarmed its founders. For another lesson is that we could easily get carried away with forecasting changes in technology and ignore social changes that may in the end be much more significant. In 1964, the New Scientist assembled contributions from more than 100 distinguished people on the likely developments over the next 20 years, what the world would look like in 1984. And I'm indebted to the PIU, who did a study looking ahead to 2020 and thought that they would gain useful information from looking back at previous exercises too. And what the panel in 1964 correctly foresaw were many of the key scientific developments. They foresaw that they'd be in the fields of information and communications technologies and biology and medicine, and they overestimated the pace of change in some areas. They thought video phones would be in widespread use by 1984, and they underestimated the pace of change in other areas. One quote I rather liked was, "Nor are computers going to get much faster." They even foresaw networks, something like the internet, used both to retrieve information and to pass messages. Though, to pick up a theme that I developed earlier, they saw the main consequences being for academic and scientific use. But the thing that most struck me from looking back at this study was the way they underestimated the pace of social change or the impact on social values. They missed the shift in family structure and all the implications that brought. And one quote rather summed that up for me. One of the very distinguished contributors in 1964 said, and I quote, "It's still very unusual indeed to find a working class wife who is allowed to drive her husband's car, but by 1984 that may be more usual." So I think we need to remember that when we look ahead and speculate about the impact of the internet on the world we live in, that it's relatively easy to project the technical trends of higher bandwidth, of greater use of wireless technologies, indeed of a world where domestic appliances and pocket devices are all connected to the internet. What's much harder to foresee is the impact on our societies, or the way indeed in which social change may interact with the new technologies. I believe the internet can and will have a positive impact on many aspects of our democratic system, in particular through the greatly increased two-way communication it allows between governments and citizens. And I welcome the continuing work the Hansard Society is doing to develop that. I hope that will help to increase interest and participation in the political process. But I suspect the greatest impact of the internet may come through the way it interacts with wider social changes in society in ways that we may simply not foresee now. The internet has unleashed huge new opportunities for people to take more control over their own lives, and I suspect that e-democracy may come about in quite unexpected ways. Thank you.
I'd like to, first of all, thank Alex Allen for an illuminating, expansive analysis of the subject, I think far more than we were entitled to hope for in one talk. I know a lot of people here will have questions they want to put to Alex. I want to raise two or three observations arising from what he said. The first is, it's not about technology at all, is it, in a sense? It's about the way that we organize society. It's about how we conceive democracy. And in that sense, it's not even just about using technology to join up government. It's about using technology to join up those people who are very often left out of the process of government, joining up the wider sphere of democracy, so that it's the people who are traditionally represented by voting once every 5 years who have a more ongoing involvement in the whole process of being governed and governing themselves. The second point that arises from the very important points that were made about trust is that trust does require regulation. People want to know that that which they trust and that the places that they go to discuss, to learn, to be informed, to express their views, are places that they can rely upon. They can rely upon the quality of the service that they receive. They can rely upon the quality of outcomes that arise from their deliberations. And I think we actually have to give far more attention than probably the early days of the internet has given to thinking about precisely how we regulate those public spaces so that they are genuinely public, so that the quality of information is of the highest kind, so that the kind of deliberation that goes on is a kind of deliberation that does lead to real policy outcomes. And I think perhaps that's going to tie in to some extent with something that is a social change right now, and that is the development of the citizenship agenda. The fact that we are teaching young people for the first time how to become good democrats, how to participate in democracy, and in a sense providing a trusted infrastructure for participating in democracy is going to be one of the important roles that not just technologists but many people are going to have to help to bring about. And I think one other observation that I'd like to just throw in at this stage, and that is, it is not about technology only, and it's not just about one technology as well. So this discussion about the internet is being filmed by BBC Parliament. But at the same time, the best way of releasing this information globally is going to be by web streaming it. It will be available on the internet. It will be available to those viewers who watch BBC Parliament. It will then be available as a text. And I think perhaps many of us here will agree that the best way that it's available is in the form that it is this evening, in face-to-face discussion. And that itself is something that mustn't be ruled out of the broad equation of strengthening democracy, bringing all of these media together and all of these situations together to create a more democratic space for us to deliberate and learn from one another. And let's try to learn from one another. I'm sure there are many people who'd like to put questions to Alex Allen. Could you identify yourselves when you speak? There's one right over in the back there.
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I'm just thinking back now to the 1997 general elections and thinking about electronic democracy as then was envisaged or implemented both by Tony Blair, basically on a sort of concept that had been portrayed in the US as an earlier model. And looking how we've evolved over the last 3 years and to which way we can go into the future, I'd like to know if you could comment briefly about the differentiation between power and authority vis-a-vis the electronic media and democracy. As I see the evolution of your discussion in terms of power as a three-way situation between people, government, and a new entity called the Internet Service Provider. And if we're looking at authority, we seem to be moving towards a sort of global entity called the International Telecommunications Union. So could you please give me a brief discussion about power authority in comparison between electronics and democracy?
Well, I think that, I mean, somewhat as Stephen said a moment ago, that we're looking at one particular medium. I believe strongly that the continued commitment by governments to liberal free market provision of telecommunications services and all the related services is crucial to not just the past development of the internet but also to the future. And that, I mean, competition is the way to stop cartels that may threaten in the way you're implying. The question of power is an interesting one, because I think one of the things the internet does is diffuse power much more widely, sometimes in ways that's uncomfortable, sometimes in ways that's wholly admirable. And it does empower people much more through their ability to communicate with others, to bring together like-minded people. And I think that will have a long-term implication on the way democracy evolves.
Yes. Could you say who you are?
My name is Beth Porter. I'm the chair of the board of SWIM, Southwest Interactive Media. I work as an independent internet consultant, the researcher on the Election 97 website when I worked at Online Magic, and now I live in the Southwest. I echo the gentleman as saying it's refreshing to see such a well-informed...
Can you hold the microphone?
Such a well-informed government minister put in charge of this exciting area. One of the areas of doubt that I have, that I also expressed when I was privileged to be part of the Boosting the Digital Economy debate, which was recently on the internet, was that with the intention of especially this government to make e-democracy a reality, the emphasis, it seems to me, is on the regulatory, it's on the provision of services, and it isn't so much, although you did mention some points, on the interactivity. And one of the things that it seems to me that frustrates people in a democratic context is not just that they have an opportunity to state what it is they want in your agenda, but to actually start to participate in setting agendas and being taken seriously. And I wonder what your comment is on that and whether the government has any plans to address that directly.
I think I better just start by saying I'm not actually a minister, I'm a civil servant. But I very much agree with that. I think that there is a huge need for using all the internet in all its manifestations, both for communication, for enabling new ways of discussion to open up, and as you say, for tapping into people's opinions and views in a way that, you know, has been much harder up to now. And so, I strongly believe that we should encourage people to believe that they can make a difference, can actually get their voice heard. And it's certainly something we're doing through experiments. The 10 Downing Street now has various website discussion forums, including one on e-democracy that Stephen contributed one of the closing pieces to. I think many government departments are thinking about ways in which they can use these technologies in order genuinely to get views about policy proposals, in order to find out how other people want the agenda to go. So I think it is, I'm sorry if I gave the impression that it was all one way. I genuinely believe that it's the two-way communication that's vital.
Up there, have a microphone at the front of upstairs. Could you identify yourself?
Richard Allen, Chair of the House of Commons Information Committee. I'd interested in Alex Allen's views on representative democracy and whether any thought is being given in government to how Parliament may change as we move from traditionally where people were represented by sending pieces of paper to their MPs who then stood up and made their case, to a situation where people will directly email government departments, thereby potentially cutting MPs out of the loop. I just wanted to say, if government are giving thought to how they can strengthen their watchdog in Parliament, and in particular to the issue of the disparity of resources which potentially exists between government, which is now getting on with it, and devoting huge resources to the internet and communication, and Parliament, which historically I think has rather lagged behind department.
Yes, well, I think I'm going to duck quite a bit of that on the grounds that, in particular, what the Parliament itself does is indeed a matter for Parliament. I welcome the efforts that are being made to produce, to provide all sorts of support for MPs in terms of not just email, not just online discussion, but all sorts of other ways in which they can use new technologies to make their job easier. In terms of people emailing government departments rather than MPs, I'm not sure at all that it will evolve like that. It may evolve like that if government departments accept emails and MPs don't, but I think all the evidence in the US, for example, is that many, many people email their elected representatives, in fact probably many more than email a government agency. And I think we will see that. Of course, it's always been possible for individuals to write to government ministers direct or to try and telephone a department if they could ever get through. And I don't really see that particular issue as being one that has huge implications for the different roles of Parliament and government.
Hello.
Brian Walker, editor of BBC Parliamentary Programmes. That was a nice civil servant's answer, if I may say so. Could we just have a little bit on? I'm just wondering, as e-envoy, did you feel a touch of heartburn last week when that nice little parliamentary answer about the sterile GM seeds getting into the mix and spreading all over the country, the government sitting on it for a month until they got some very, very tidy answers ready and then allowing us to know the result? What do you think the connection is between e-democracy, freedom of information, and how might a greater level of e-democracy affect the debate that might have brought some different results in this kind of case?
Well, I'm glad to say that that particular subject is doesn't quite fall within the e-envoy agenda, so I'm being very, even more of a civil servant. But there are two things I want to make in points I want to make in response to that. One is that I think the issue of GM foods is an interesting one in terms of the way I mentioned that it can be the news agenda, the how people learn about information can change radically, and how governments and indeed other bodies are going to have to adjust to how they communicate, how they set communication strategies in the new era. And certainly GM foods is an interesting example in how we can get across information on food safety in a way that is commands trust. I mean, I speak with a little bit of feeling since I was the Prime Minister's principal private secretary in 1995 or whenever it was, when the Mad Cow episode took place. And that was a very interesting and difficult experience in that, on the one hand, there were huge swings in public opinion and sort of tabloid headlines changed between, you know, government lies killing our children to why won't bloody foreigners eat our beef within a space of about 10 days. And that made it a difficult issue to handle. But it was also illustrated the difficulty of actually communicating scientific opinion and displayed some of the points I've made about the lack of trust in official announcements. I mean, it is an incredibly difficult question when you're asked, can you guarantee that something is absolutely safe? I mean, there's really no answer to that. And I think one of the ways forward is doing, publishing a lot more of the information, enabling people to look at issues themselves so that they can take a more informed viewpoint. And certainly that has implications for open government. I mean, it is happening in one sense, in the amount of government information that is now available through websites is huge. And what's more, it's not just, in the past, they might say information was available and, you know, if you write in and know exactly what you want and send exactly the right amount of money, we'll let you have it, or, you know, you can come into this office and browse through a file between, you know, 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoons or whatever the case might have been. Now, there's a lot more information available there. I mean, you know, extensive information going back in time. And it's available in a way that anybody who has an internet connection can actually access it. And I mean, striking, I mean, the Treasury, which was my home department some time ago at any rate. I mean, you know, if you want to look through past budget decisions, they've got them all archived there. You've got complete budget documents. You've got the complete press notices, everything there, in a way that, you know, would have been unthinkable a few years ago, that if somebody wanted to find out an Inland Revenue press notice on the 1997 budget, I mean, it would have been almost impossible. Now you can find it in 2 minutes.
And can I just add to that? I mean, one of the cliches of politics, aren't they, is that the people want to know. And very often that might mean the news editors have decided that this is what the people want to know. I mean, sometimes the news editors are quite right, sometimes they're not. It seems to me that one of the things that the new technology does is it allows the people, to some extent at least, to determine what it is they want to know and what extent they want to know about things before they're satisfied. There's a question just there.
Lord Errol, House of Lords, Parliamentary Office and Science and Technology, among other things. I've noticed that over the last century, as communications have got centralised more and more, decisions are taken at the centre and you start to get information overload. one of the challenges I'd have thought with you with the internet is if you're getting more and more stuff coming into the center, you're going to have a problem handling the sheer volume of information and the pressure to make decisions quickly, which you've in fact just highlighted. And one of the important things sometimes is to stand back from a problem, think about it before you take precipitate action. Sometimes you have to take precipitate or you have to take immediate action to stop a problem escalating. Do you see this as a major challenge in the near future, handling these things and how you differentiate between the two? That's the first thing. Secondly, I might be able to help you on the business about giving details over the internet, which is private businesses tend to be helping you, enabling you, or giving you something. Governments tend to be either restricting your form of action or taking money away or restricting your money.
On dealing with, dealing with information clearly is an issue, and there are incredible statistics around on, not just government officials, but businessmen, you know, on how many emails and how much information they receive in a typical working day. I'm not sure I agree with your point about everything coming to the centre more and more. I mean, you know, this is in some sense, you know, again, outside my remit, but I mean, they're quite separate programmes of devolving decisions closer to the people. But, I'm just not convinced at the moment that's a problem. I mean, I very much agree with you about the need to step back sometimes and not to rush into decisions, and certainly the way that the political process, it's speeded up by the internet, certainly demands instant statements, instant answers, can be an inhibition. But I'd like to think that governments are capable of standing back. It is hard, but there's certainly times I agree when it's very necessary.
Can somebody turn up Alex Allen's microphone? I think some people here can't hear. Some people in the back couldn't hear what was being said. Question there.
Hi, my name is Nick Jones. I'm an analyst with an internet research firm, Jupiter Communications. I've been covering the internet for about 6 years, and one thing I consistently see is that when it's persuading a constituency, a group of users or consumers to go online, there's usually an incentive involved. I was very interested to hear specifically about the MPs, less than half of the MPs using email, for example, or using the internet. I'm just wondering how you would incentivize MPs to interact via their email, and then maybe talk about on a slightly wider angle. You know, for example, online airlines give a discount to encourage people to use the cheaper channel of communication. I'm just wondering which government services would be first up for such discounts, or what other incentives might be used to persuade people to switch to the internet channel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, in terms of MPs, I mean, I think it will be one of the pressures will actually come from the demand from their constituents as more and more people get used to emailing each other. So, they will feel it more and more unusual if their MP doesn't happen to publish an email address or answer emails. I mean, it's something, as David mentioned in his introduction, I found when I was in the Foreign Office, when I first went out to Canberra, I found it completely frustrating that, you know, I could conduct email conversations with my mother and my friends in the UK, and I couldn't email anybody in the Foreign Office in London, and that seemed an extraordinary way for a department whose basis is information to operate. I'm glad to say that over the time I was there, they've changed, and you can now do that, but that they were slow to get going. In terms of incentives, we are giving incentives. I mean, there is a £10 discount if you file your self-assessment tax return online. There are there are separate provisions for some of the other inland revenue and customs. There will be for the customs forms that are when you can submit them online. So we, you know, the principle that there may be a good case for providing incentives to encourage take-up is there. And we do at the same time have to be very careful about issues like the so-called digital divide. We want to use the internet to provide better services and more efficiently because, you know, we believe that enables us to do so. We certainly don't want to do that in a way that cuts out a lot of people from better services. And so, you know, I think we will continue to enable a variety of channels for accessing government services. And linked into that, we're also taking, trying to do as much as we can to enable people to have internet access. There are a number of different ways in which it's done. I mean, one, of course, is encouraging more competition in the telecoms industry, driving down prices. I mean, to the extent that, I'm sorry, I'm getting on a bit of propaganda here, but Britain now has the lowest off-peak internet connection fees of anywhere in the OECD countries. And we're doing it equally by rolling out IT learning centres, wiring up the all the schools, all the libraries, through schemes of providing incentives, through reconditioned computers to some of the people on benefits, through discounts on IT courses to people with individual learning accounts. And so, I mean, the issue is there are a whole range of encouragements and incentives, as I say, not just aimed at early adopters who may leap in, but also in terms of encouraging people to get online.
Anne McDade from the Home Office. Whilst acknowledging that there are going to be exciting developments ahead in both internet development and e-democracy development, what thought and planning perhaps is being given to the needs of a whole section of society that at the moment are outside of internet access and e-democracy access? And I'm thinking obviously of the older population who are less likely to take up whatever incentives might be offered. There is a danger we are creating a situation where they will actually be excluded more and more from democracy and the whole communication system.
Well, I mean, clearly, I think it extends across all age ranges. And there's, I mean, I saw a survey published, I think, pretty recently that indicated, quite a lot of elderly people are taking up internet access enthusiastically. It's not as simple as just by age. I mean, equally, I think technologies are going to come when it will be much easier for people to interact. I mean, for example, with digital television, as that develops, and it's already taking off at a phenomenal rate. That will provide interactive capabilities, internet access, and that will be in people's homes in a way that people who may not be able to go out easily to a local IT learning center or local library may actually be able to do it in their own home. So I agree, it is very important that we maintain an inclusive agenda, that we make sure that we're not just providing services and equally we're not just opening up democracy to a small group who are able and willing to get online. And I thought that one of the points about the consultation that the Hansard Society ran on domestic violence was very important, that a great many of the women who participated in that had not previously had internet access or certainly had not previously participated in online forums. And there are other examples. I remember Margaret Moran telling me that when she was at Lewisham and they ran a project called Lewisham Listens, there were surprising results in terms of people's interests in using interactive technologies to provide feedback, and ethnic minorities and elderly people were quite well represented among those who were keen to take on these technologies.
I wonder if in the spirit of interactivity there's anyone here who now wants to sort of give some comments to Alex Allen to take back to feed into the policy process on e-democracy. And you've heard from Alex Allen, what should you be telling him and he be telling government?
Well, firstly, I think over 30 years...
Could you wait for the microphone and tell us who you are?
My name is Gary Mills. I'm an e-citizen from Gloucester.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Over 30 years, I've had dealings with various aspects of the government. And over that 30-year period, I've seen the customer service that has been provided by our civil servants get considerably better. To the extent now, I'm very happy to have dealings with the civil servants, mostly. We still have some of the old dinosaurs that no doubt through retirement we'll get rid of them, but as the younger people come along, and there are many here tonight, I'm sure, I hope they would agree that the civil servants we have in this country are, most importantly, independent. They're independent of government, they're independent of the members of parliament. E-democracy, perhaps, what safeguards will be put in place to ensure the independence of that wonderful institution called our civil service? That's what I'm concerned about. Because I think that as this rules out, could our civil service become marginalised?
Well, that's a challenging one for you, Alex.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm not sure it does have... I mean, I think it has big implications for the organisation of the civil service and the sorts of jobs that are done. I'm not sure it has big implications for the role of the civil service in terms of its political neutrality and its independence from, you know, the government of the day. I think it's, you know, in some ways that what we will see is very different structures of departments, and we will see, you know, some functions disappear, we will see other functions grow, and that's always been the case. I think this may accelerate the pace of change. But we will still have the principle that we have an impartial civil service who implements the policies set by ministers, and ministers are, you know, the elected representatives accountable to Parliament. So I don't actually think that will change fundamentally.
Somebody just at the back there is going to...
Hi, I'm Doug Forbes from Barony Consulting. We also run a site called the Centre for E-Government, so it's very appropriate. There's obviously a number of unintended consequences in this debate and unintended consequences regarding e-democracy. One is the age-old saying of voting with your feet is likely to be changed. Voting with your fingers, voting with your laptop, whatever. Internet's about communications, but one of the things, or questions and serious issues I would like somebody to address here, and I understand there's a number of people from the BBC, is, are the BBC fully geared up for this? Because there are a number of challenges that, in my view, they seem to be missing. And if there is any questions in terms of policy, I'd like to address, maybe it's not the right civil servant to address that at, but certainly I think somebody from the audience may want to let us know what the BBC is actually doing, apart from just a website, because there are some important things they may be missing.
I think somebody there.
Don De Silva from the Black Information Link, which is UK's premier website for communities. I'd like to turn your attention to the possibility in which the internet would be used to abuse democracy. I'd like to try and expand on that, because there is a neat thing to ways in which you can deal with such abuse quickly, and that is not being done at the moment. Thank you.
I'm not sure I know. I mean, do you have particular examples that you...
For instance, in terms of peddling wrong information against another particular section of the community?
I mean, that is an issue. I mean, it's a problem not just in the UK. It's a problem worldwide. I mean, I noticed the Simon Wiesenthal Centre has the... I mean, collects information about websites around the world that promote anti-Semitism, racial hatred, and terrorism and issues like that. And I mean, the number is something like, I know the last count was over 2,000. And they are working with internet service providers to persuade them to take them down. And Yahoo recently took down quite a number of racial hatred sites. And I think that has to be the way to go. It's clearly, if an offence is committed under the UK legislation, then, you know, the government can act in that. If this is outside the UK jurisdiction, or it is, you know, an objectionable website but not against the law as it stands, then I think action through persuading internet service providers is one of the avenues that are open.
Maybe that, the front. Have your hand up? Sorry, somebody
in the front. Sorry, there. Just a Nathan McWinnie from European Public Policy Advisors. It was really, as voting becomes much, much easier, how you, the dangers of kind of e-democracy becoming an e-majority tyranny, where people, if it's very easy to vote on issues like Clause 28, can the arguments the government can have for not just simply making those internet polls effectively, and you'll get people making decisions which are affecting society in quite a tyrannical way. What are the arguments that government can use that you mustn't have
too direct a democracy?
Well, I mean, I think that's an issue I addressed. It's once you open the, you know, take the genie out the bottle of enabling, you know, universal consultation through very easy internet access and, you know, you start online voting, then you do have to recognize that it raises issues about our system of representative democracy. And I mean, that, you know, the sorts of issues you describe are very much the ones that do concern people. I think this is, I mean, I think as it happens, the technology before we are ready to really seriously look at internet voting is a little way in the future. And I think that, you know, that's probably just as well, because I think it gives us a period to reflect on how we would want to do that and how we would want to implement. I mean, clearly it's desirable to increase participation if that can be done, but at the same time, you know, we can't just look at that in isolation without considering the wider implications. I'm just going to pick up point on the BBC, since the BBC don't seem to be and I don't speak for the BBC, but I mean, the BBC's the information they do put out on the web is, I mean, very remarkable and a huge asset. I mean, and one of the things that amazed me is, I mean, something, I mean, I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but something like 3/4 of children taking GCSE last year logged on to the BBC's revision sites to get information and do it. I think that, you know, there is an extensive use made of all the BBC services.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. I think the BBC website is excellent. And one of the things that worries me is that some people seem to think that there is something called the internet and you judge it, or the World Wide Web and you judge it. There is good quality information and there's bad information. There's good discussion, which is well regulated and which means something, and there's discussion which is trivial and pointless. There's polling, which is rather like the Sun doing a poll on Clause 28. And there is also polling in which one authenticates votes and has some kind of representative meaning. And it seems to me that what we need to be striving to do here is not necessarily playing with the technology. We need to be shaping the politics so that the thing actually works in the interest of democracy. And you know, that I hope is something that the Hansard Society's e-democracy program is working towards doing, certainly in collaboration with people in Parliament who have an interest in doing this. And it's something which Alex Allen, I think, is doing a splendid job so far in promoting within government. And I think perhaps the fact that he's not a minister, as was suggested earlier, is one of the things. Yes.
I want to ask you two absolutely practical questions. One, anybody here who wants to go home or show their family or anybody else what's happened here, what do they log on to? And secondly, if they want to pursue these matters with the Hansard Society, and ask Stephen further questions, what do they log on to? So could you give two email addresses?
Yes. I think if you want to see the event that you've been at this evening, or if you want to know more about things, I'm sure the BBC website, having filmed it, is going to stream it. But also you can see it on the Hansard Society website, the address of which is in your pack, www.hansardsociety, all one word, all lowercase, .org.uk. And if there's anybody here who wants to take up any of the points raised with me, and I think Alex Allen will give his department's email address as well, I am edemocracy@lse.ac.uk. Very happy to hear from all of you, and I look forward to suffering from information overload for the next few days.
And what's your address, Alex?
Mine's eenvoy, that's e-envoy, @open.gov.uk.
And I won't embarrass you, David, by asking you yours, because I don't think you remember.
I'm not very good on it. Anyway, do it through the Hansard Society. Stephen is much better than I at this. It only remains to me to thank you for being an audience to this important statement, and to thank Alex Allen. He has shown the civil service virtues of clarity and neutrality in a high degree. He has not, I think, gone too far in showing the civil service vices of ultra caution or small c conservatism. And he has shown virtues not always attributed to the civil service of innovation, inspiration, open-mindedness. Alex, we're extremely grateful to you for coming to us this evening.
Thank you.